Everywhere I go, I see people who know something is terribly wrong. They say there's nothing anyone can do about it now. It's been going on for way too long. And all we can do is just learn how to cope, try to make it through another year. Yeah, who needs dictatorship or martial law when you got TV, dependence, and fear? Meanwhile, the kings and queens in their castles are trying to turn everything they touch into gold. And even the devastation they leave in their wake is a new market to be bought and then sold. I feel like I'm clear cut. I feel like my rivers have run dry. And I'm raw beneath the open sky and the rain. When it comes, will carry me away in a landslide. If this broken world was all I knew, and all I heard was sorrow's cry, what would I know of anger and hope, or for what would be worthy to die? But I have seen forests as old as riverbeds. I've seen trees that rise up to the dawn. And I have known love that rises above the despair that this cruel world brings on. I've seen beauty in the eyes of another. I've heard music you would not believe. And the source of my pain is the source of my hope in a vision of what this world could be.
Ethan Miller and Kate Boverman. Our final talk was given last February before the University of Washington Student Legal Animal Defense Fund.
My name is Will Potter. I'm a reporter. I'm based in Washington, D.C., and I focus on how the war on terrorism has impacted civil liberties, specifically focusing on eco-terrorism rhetoric and the crackdown against the environmental and animal rights movements. And I've been covering that since about 2000, and then this past May, I testified before the House Judiciary Committee in Washington, D.C. about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. So tonight, I'm going to talk a little bit about the legislation, but also to pull it back a little bit and talk about what a lot of activists are calling the Green Scare more broadly. But before I do that, I have to admit, I've never done a PowerPoint ever at a presentation, and that's for a reason. But before I want to get started, I just want to show some images without a full-blown little presentation, just to keep in mind as we're moving forward, just to take a look at the images. These are ads and documents and some other things that have been floating around with the Green Scare. These are both ad campaigns. This one about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and it ran in Roll Call and The Hill, which are two newspapers for Capitol Hill that are read by members of Congress and their staff almost exclusively. This was from a publication by the National Rifle Association that was leaked out. You think the NRA would like explosives, but apparently not. And this one, I guess I blew it up a little too much. This was from, I'm sure you guys know about the fur salon in Portland called Schumacher's Furs that eventually shut down, and looks like they've relocated. But it's been the subject of a long campaign by animal rights activists against the fur industry. And this is what the owner put in his window: all protesters should be beaten, strangled, skinned alive, and anally electrocuted. And then he went on in the next quote in his newspaper, in the newspaper article he was talking to a reporter about, to call the protesters terrorists. This was an anonymous ad campaign in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and I think the Philly Inquirer as well. So in May, like I said, I was invited to testify before the House Judiciary Committee about this Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And I've been covering the legislation and similar legislation, the Green Scare in general, since about 2000, and know that other activists and reporters have been compelled to testify before congressional committees. But this didn't really seem like there wasn't a whole lot of malice involved, so I didn't think it was that much of a big deal. If anything, I was a little bit flattered by the whole thing. And so minutes after I got the phone call, I went over to a colleague's office, and I kind of burst into his office with a hotshot grin, talking about how I was going to testify before Congress, and kind of felt a little redeemed that after covering this stuff for years, that finally I got a little bit of attention. The green scare has been building for quite some time. I was also hoping for not a pat on the back, but maybe a little bit of, you have nothing to worry about, you're going to do great, everything's going to go just fine, some support, because we weren't great friends, but we had a working relationship and we were with each other every day. Instead, he closed his office door, he turned to me, and even though the door was closed, looked to each side, and then kind of whispered, do you think that's a good idea? And mind you, he didn't know much about this legislation. He didn't know much about eco-terrorism ad campaigns. He didn't know much about industry smear campaigns and calling children's movies softcore eco-terrorism. He didn't know much about the FBI harassment. He didn't know about the grand jury witch hunts or the trial of the Shack 7 or the home raids or the terrorism enhancement penalties or the no-fly list. Or he didn't really need to know any of that, because he knew that in this with us or against us war on terrorism, he didn't want to be in the against us camp, and he didn't want me to be either. So to be clear, I'm not bringing this up to talk down in any way about him, because I like him very much. We could get along great. And I'm also not saying it to act like I was being brave in this, because we all know in this war on terrorism, if you're a white middle-class male that grew up in Texas, you probably aren't going to be worried about being shipped to Guantanamo. The Bush administration is going after different groups of people for that, Arab Americans and immigrants. But I bring it up because I think it indicates the key point of what I wanted to talk about tonight: fear. It's how ingrained the fear of the war on terrorism has become in people that aren't embedded in these social movements and that don't really know the ins and outs of everything going on, but they know enough that they should be a little bit afraid. Corporations and the politicians that represent them say legislation and sweeping government powers are needed to go after illegal underground groups like the Animal Liberation Front and Earth Liberation Front, and people that have done things like broken windows and snuck into fur farms and let out mink, or broken into laboratories and rescued rabbits and beagles. They say that existing legislation doesn't go far enough and you have to crack down on the domestic terrorists. But I'm going to argue today that the underground activists aren't the ones most affected by this green scare. In fact, I don't think they're even really the targets. The point of all of this, to borrow some legal jargon, which I'm sure you all are very familiar with, is that it's to induce a chilling effect. The war on terrorism is being used as a pretext to chill dissent in the name of protecting corporate profits. An informal coalition of industry groups, corporations, and corporate politicians have taken a few pages from the Red Scare playbook and a few from the With Us or Against Us playbook of the war on terrorism and concocted what activists are calling the Green Scare. The Green Scare, which is, I think, McCarthyism 2.0, is being built upon a foundation of fear. They're doing this really through three avenues that I'm going to talk about briefly. That's the courts, legislation, and something that I would call extra-legal, which is the scaremongering campaigns, which we just saw on the PowerPoint right now, the ad campaigns, the eco-terrorist rhetoric in the press. The new McCarthyists have used their deep pocketbooks and PR savvy to place a terrorist in every shadow. They're taking out full-page ads, anonymous ads, in the New York Times and the Washington Post, saying that the New York Stock Exchange has been held hostage by animal rights terrorists, although there are no bombs, no planes into buildings, just activists that campaign their butts off to get a company delisted from the New York Stock Exchange. The National Association for Biomedical Research took out a full-page ad in Roll Call, which I said was a newspaper of Capitol Hill, with that red spray paint saying, "Your home is next." The unspoken but very clear message was, members of Congress, if you don't support this bill, you could be next. And then they've taken out ads that we just saw about the individuals with all the black masks and they're holding axes, and some of them had leather jackets, which I found kind of funny if they clearly didn't do their research on the animal rights movement, because I don't think that would go over very well. But those posters, and it was also an ad campaign, are only $5 from the National Association for Biomedical Research. And when you do your PayPal checkout, it's called Domestic Terrorist Poster, which I think is kind of funny. But not even children's movies are safe from all the scaremongering. Have you guys heard of a movie called Hoot?
Yeah.
It was a popular kids' book. When it came out in film, Cybercast News Service, which isn't a news service, it's a right-wing website, they called it softcore eco-terrorism for kids. And they called it that because the teenage protagonist tried to save an endangered owl from developers. It's kind of like Free Willy and countless other kids' books. But the teenage activist's campaign of terror and wanton, ruthless destruction, including putting alligators in porta potties. So green scare pioneer Ron Arnold, who is this free market, you know, you always got to watch out when you use those kind of words. He's a free market individualist, and I've seen all these kind of words describing him. He had never seen the film when he was interviewed by Cybercast News Service, and they note that in the article. But he still said, quote, "Hoot's so-called harmless mischief is training a generation to look cute while burning homes and cars and stores." The scaremongering would be pretty laughable if it hadn't worked its way into the top levels of government. John Lewis is the top dog of the FBI in charge of domestic terrorism, and he said, quote, "The number one domestic terrorism threat is the eco-terrorism animal rights movement. The Department of Homeland Security doesn't list right-wing terrorists on a list of national security threats, even though those groups have been responsible for admittedly trying to create weapons of mass destruction, bombing the Oklahoma City building, the Olympic Park bombings in Atlanta, killing abortion doctors. The animal rights and environmental movements have done nothing like that. No human being has ever been injured by what these people would call the most extreme elements of those movements, not one. But those movements have committed what is ultimately an even deadlier sin, which is targeting corporate profits. Listen to this quote from a presentation given to corporations by the Overseas Security Advisory Council, which in D.C. jargon is a very big division of the State Department that briefs corporations that have interests in Western Europe and different regions of the world. This is what they said. "Although incidents related to terrorism are most likely to make the front page news, animal rights extremism is what's most likely to affect your day-to-day business operations." Think about that for a second. "Although incidents related to terrorism are most likely to make the front page news, animal rights extremism is most likely to affect your day-to-day business operations." It's a pretty damning admission of the government's intent. And it's not an isolated statement. The Department of Homeland Security said as much in a bulletin that was circulated to law enforcement agencies. And they said, quote, "Attacks against corporations by animal rights extremists and eco-terrorists are costly to the targeted company and, over time, can undermine confidence in the economy." Undermine confidence in the economy. In this briefing, they didn't mention once the word violence. The briefing goes on to warn about eco-terrorism like flyer distribution. Those words were used. Flying distributions, quote, "tying up company phone lines, in addition to other extremist tactics like, quote, organizing protests, and also, unfortunately, a quote, inundating computers with emails." DHS notes in passing that illegal actions like verbal harassment and vandalism, illegal but not violent crimes, but nowhere in the bulletin is the word violence used. Not once. So all this scaremongering, though, hasn't deterred underground activists. Remember what I started off by saying, that's really supposed to be the whole point of all of this, is to stop the illegal underground activists, right? And in fact, it may have added a bit of fuel to their fire. The same day, the Shack 7, which is a group of activists that were convicted of, quote, animal enterprise terrorism for running a website that listed news of both legal and illegal actions. The same day that they were convicted, a group of anonymous activists, or I'm assuming it's a group, sent out a communique, and they claimed credit for rescuing 23 rabbits from a vivisection lab in rural Massachusetts. They said the action was in honor of the Shack 7, and six of the rabbits are named Jake, Lauren, Kevin, Andy, Josh, and Darius after the defendants. I didn't realize that the balaclava and bolt cutter set were very PR savvy, but apparently they are. And this is from the communique. We will fight back for them. Animal liberation is an idea whose time has come and a reality that any of us can create. The government and the industries it represents hate us so much because no matter who they surveil, raid, defame, or imprison, they cannot kill the idea, and so they cannot stop us. And while the Shack 7 will soon go to jail for simply speaking out on behalf of animals, those of us who have actually done all the nasty stuff talked about in the courts and in the media will still be free. So to those of you who still work with HLS, which is the lab, and to all those who abuse animals, we're coming for you, mother... And I laughed, too, when I said it. I don't need to make light of, you know, serious property crimes and things like that, but we got to remember what we're dealing with here. This is what the animal rights and environmental movements have been about, the so-called the most militant extreme wings, even if I concede that kind of rhetoric. That's what it's about. It's about property crimes and freeing animals or stealing animals, depending on who you interview, and then sending out really strongly worded communiques that posture and use a lot of tough rhetoric. And I think even people in the movements admit that. There's a lot of machismo. There's a lot of, like, you know, support the underground, super radical type talk, but they've never hurt a single human being. But keep in mind, if outlandish prison sentences and eco-terrorism rhetoric aren't deterring crimes or even solving the hundreds of unsolved, quote, eco-terrorism crimes on the books, according to the FBI, then what's the point of it all? And I would argue the point is fear and protecting corporate profits. But they really go hand in hand right now. The point is to protect corporate profits by instilling the fear in the mainstream animal rights and environmental movements and every other social movement that's paying attention and has a clue what's going on right now and make people think twice about using their First Amendment rights. That's the legal definition of a chilling effect. So when activists like Jeff Hogg and independent journalist Josh Wolf and many others are hauled before grand juries and threatened with jail time unless they discuss their political beliefs and political associations, you start to wonder if you'll get hit with the same if you stick your neck out a little bit too far. When a nonviolent activist like Adam Duran gets 180 days in jail, plus $1,500 in fines, plus probation, plus 100 hours of community service, all for making an undercover documentary about abusive situations in a factory farm, you start to wonder if that could happen to you. When the government rounds up prominent environmental activists as part of Operation Backfire and charges them with serious, very serious property crimes from years and years ago that have gone unsolved, and that the statute of limitations was about to expire on all those, coincidentally, then smears them in the press as eco-terrorists and pretty much eliminating any hope for a fair trial, you start to wonder who's going to knock on your door. And then when the Shack 7 are convicted on animal enterprise terrorism for just running a website, and they're never even accused of breaking a window or gluing a lock or doing anything illegal, let alone violent, you start to wonder if you're going to be next. Industry groups and corporations understand the power of fear. That's why just a few months ago they pushed their most ambitious scaremongering campaign yet. So as background, they've been pushing this Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and they've called it the Ecological and Animal Terrorism Act and all kinds of different words, but typically it just fails every single time. It fizzles out miserably. It usually stalls out at the committee or subcommittee level, which is even worse. Then they reintroduce it the next session. It stalls out again at the subcommittee or committee level. It keeps going and going and going. They've been doing this since the original Animal Enterprise Protection Act, which is the foundation of all this, was passed in 1992. They've got a couple of expansions, but they never really got what they wanted. What they really wanted was a full-blown terrorism bill with insane penalties, with the terrorism rhetoric that goes after the mainstream movement and ostensibly targeting the underground. So then, come last September, the Senate was able to rush through, before congressional recess for November campaigning, the Senate version of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And it was a little bit better than the bill that I testified about in the House, but it was basically the same thing. The House wasn't able to do that. They knew that if these elections went bad and the Democrats got control, it didn't mean they couldn't get their legislation passed, because the Dems have co-sponsored the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and they really can't be dependent on for anything in my mind at this point. They've co-sponsored it, but it weakens their chances in the next session. So keeping that in mind, the first day back from November campaigning, the very first day, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act came up as part of an arcane procedure called a suspension of the rules. It's meant for non-controversial bills in the House. And so what happens, the intent is supposed to be bills that aren't controversial. You put them all on a plate together. You deal with them one after another, rapid fire. You can kind of expedite things, get them out the door. It's for, you know, minor things like here's an even better example than what I was about to say. On the same day the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act was on the suspension of the rules calendar, there's a motion honoring a baseball team for winning the World Series. That's what we're dealing with. Terrorism, baseball. It's all conflated. So on that day, they passed it in the House with 6 members of Congress in the room as part of the suspension of the rules. A lot of members of Congress were actually still outside breaking ground for the new Martin Luther King Memorial, who they all praised as a noble civil rights leader, but who, in a different time, could easily have been branded a terrorist. But on the first day back from congressional recess and November campaigning, you know, who cares about the Foley scandal or domestic spying, Guantanamo, the war in Iraq, healthcare, education, Social Security, when we can be giving GlaxoSmithKline, Pfizer, and Wyeth exactly what they want? So like I said, it expanded the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. And under this law, there are really 2 ways that anyone in this room or any activist or member of the general public could come into could come under fire by the legislation. The first is it targets anyone who intentionally damages or causes the loss of any real or personal property used by an animal enterprise, or any real or personal property of any person or entity having a connection to, relationship with, or transaction with an animal enterprise. So anyone who does any business with an animal enterprise, if you target them, it could be brought under this legislation. Now, when I testified, I got hammered by members of Congress that said, we're only going after real damage to real property, like physically destroying a piece of property, like breaking a window. But it just doesn't make any sense, because in the definition section of the legislation, they spell out economic damage as including the loss of profits. So there's a lot of very underhanded things going on at the committee level. I mean, these people are pros. They know about every comma, every period, every colon, every semicolon in this piece of legislation matters and could matter at the trial and appellate level, and they chose to stick with this. The other way of coming on under contact with this legislation is, I think it could be even a little bit more dangerous. And it says this: anyone who intentionally places a person in reasonable fear of the death of or serious bodily injury to that person, member of their family, etc., involving through a course of conduct that involves threats, acts of vandalism, property damage, and here's the kicker: criminal trespass, harassment, or intimidation. So let's break that out into plain English. Here's a very likely scenario. A group of activists holds a loud protest outside an executive's home on a regular basis, maybe an office building, to make it even a little bit more mainstream. Outside of an office building on a regular basis. Some of those activists are wearing black masks. They don't necessarily look as butch as this guy, but they may be skinny vegans with black masks. But they don't want to be listed on no-fly list. They don't want their picture in the paper about a story the next day about eco-terrorists targeting corporation, whatever. They don't want their faces used. Activists are yelling, chanting as people entering the building, as activists sometimes do. Some wear masks or bandanas, like I said, and there have also been illegal actions in the campaign, maybe a little vandalism, property damage, trespassing, which has been the case in every social movement ever, as far as I've been able to find out. So activists clearly intend to, quote, interfere with the operations of an animal enterprise, and then you toss in the climate of fear, which is what we saw earlier, plus the raucous nature of the protests and the fact that it's part of a coordinated interstate campaign, and all of a sudden this First Amendment activity becomes terrorism. And if you think that's extreme, the original legislation has only been used twice. The Animal Enterprise Protection Act. One use was to go after Justin Samuel and Peter Young, who broke into fur farms, let loose a bunch of mink. The other was the case of the Shack 7, who never broke into a fur farm, never broke anything, according to the government, and were charged with running a website. First Amendment activity is already being targeted. But the kicker here is that clause, reasonable fear. Because when we look at situations like this, we have New York Times and Washington Post ad campaigns, animal rights terrorists by the NRA, ads in Roll Call and Capitol Hill, more ads that were in a small, I remember being in, seeing this in an Arkansas publication that I have at home. It's all over the place. Top tier media outlets all the way to the bottom. The softcore eco-terrorism stuff from Hoot got its way into the Houston Chronicle. I mean, this isn't some fringe element. It's working its way into mainstream press. So all of a sudden, the unreasonable becomes reasonable. Now, on top of all this, the bill spells out penalties for activity that does not instill in another the reasonable fear or serious bodily injury or death and results in no economic damage or bodily injury. So it also then begs the question, if you're not causing serious bodily injury or death and you're not causing economic damage, what kind of activists are going to be targeted by this legislation? Now, members of Congress say again and again this is not going to target First Amendment activity. They even have a ridiculous clause in the bill that says it doesn't target First Amendment activity. Which, you know, we should all thank them for reminding us that there's still a First Amendment and they can't make blatantly unconstitutional legislation. But it just begs the question, if it's not targeting violence, it's not targeting economic damage, who are the terrorists? And that's what has a lot of people afraid, and I think justifiably so. But the Red Scare operated on exactly the same terms, all the way from the congressional hearings, the grand juries, the rhetoric, the arrests, everything is, in some ways, very similar. And one of the cases that I came across was Lamont versus the Postmaster General. And what really interested me about this is that there was a federal law that said anyone receiving communist political propaganda through the post office had to specifically authorize the delivery of each piece of mail. Now, the law, just like members of Congress say about the AETA, didn't outlaw First Amendment activity. It didn't say you can't receive communist political propaganda. It says you didn't say you can't send it. It didn't say you can't be a communist. It's technically on par with the First Amendment, right? But it just said you had to authorize it. So anybody paying attention knows they don't want to authorize this and being put on some kind of list. So it had the same effect. It had that chilling effect. I think this is one of the earliest reference I've found of that kind of a concept. Because you just have to be a total nut job, or especially brave, or maybe a little bit of both, to go up to the post office, put your name down, physically put your name down to receive communist political propaganda. And that's what the Supreme Court said. They're like, this has a chilling effect. It chills public discourse, even though it doesn't outlaw a specific type of discourse. But this McCarthyism 2.0 is running exactly the same way. U.S. Representative George Nethercutt is from the good old Northwest, and he's not in office anymore. But he said at a congressional hearing a while back that, quote, "National environmental groups need to know you are either with us or against us. You need to choose which side you are on, and you know we will be watching. Financing and harboring terrorists is no different than directly committing the acts. These dangerous and misguided zealots must be left without aid or moral comfort. This is the moral framework." This wasn't a congressional hearing. I mean, this wasn't some inside the beltway kind of banter. I mean, he said this on the record in a congressional hearing. And industry groups have said just as much. There's one group called the Center for Consumer Freedom, which is just a front group for fast food corporations and the tobacco and alcohol industry. And they said, David Martosko is the mouthpiece over there, and he said, quote, "The Shaq trial is just the starting gun. This isn't going to end anytime soon." But this could also be the starting gun for activists as well. I've talked with hundreds of activists around the country over the years of writing about this. And now more than ever, there's a lot of fear, and there's a lot of unease about where this is all going. But there's also a hell of a lot of rage, and I think that's a really good thing. In terms of activists are mobilizing themselves all over the country, outside of members of Congress's offices, doing legal trainings like you guys had going on, all kinds of things all over the country. So back to the PowerPoint for a second. I'm going to show you a few less terrorizing photos. This was in South Africa on December 7th in solidarity with the people that were arrested as part of Operation Backfire. This was in Greece on the same day. This, I swear I didn't pay this person to promo my website. I was in New York. Banner hangs in Minneapolis or Milwaukee. I can't remember which. These are activists in Massachusetts that when the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act passed, a bunch of students went outside the McGovern's office and said, you need to meet with us. This is unacceptable. You weren't on the floor. You didn't oppose this. Where were you to let this pass? And McGovern has a pretty solid record on civil liberties issues and also on animal issues, apparently, and environmental issues. So they had their demo. I got some media coverage. Then they went in. McGovern's staff invited them in, met with them, and then he came out on record with a statement to the press saying, I'm going to advocate repeal of this legislation, which is just amazing to me. And this is just a few activists organizing. This was in Florida on a similar event. This is one of my favorites. The Shaq 7 have a posse doing time without doing a crime. But, I mean, I want to caution that the analogies I'm making to the Red Scare are just that. They're just analogies. I mean, we can't look to past eras of repression to decide how to act now. But we can look to past eras to figure out the mindset, how things work, and what we can learn from them so we're not repeating history. But a lot of the tactics of today do replicate everything that went on during the Red Scare. The grand juries, the congressional witch hunts, the with us or against us rhetoric, the arrests, everything about it, the no-fly lists, but in a different context. But our responses to that can't mimic the responses during the Red Scare, because naming names and pledging loyalty oaths didn't work then, and it's sure as hell not going to work now. It's not going to work for activists to cowardly distance themselves from the so-called eco-terrorists to try to save their own teeth, as many did during the Red Scare and as some national organizations are trying to do now. Condemning underground activists or anyone charged with illegal actions isn't going to get anybody off the hook. And it also just furthers the idea that some of the stuff like this Shaq campaign was indeed illegal, which I would not argue. It's First Amendment activity. Naming names and pledging loyalty oaths didn't help anyone then, and I can't say it enough that it's not going to help anyone now. The only way anyone's going to get out of this is by coming out and confronting it head on. That means working with anti-abortion activists, anti-war activists, and others, and telling them that the Greens and the animal rights activists, to use a non-animal rights analogy, are literally the canaries in the mine. The New York Stock Exchange ad that I had up there, NYSE held hostage, on their website, they talk about other social movements. They talk about the Communication Workers of America. Not one organization you list as a terrorist group by any means. I don't even know what they're doing these days. But, you know, they're pushing for corporate reforms, and they put on their website a note to other industries saying, you could be next. And that's why all eyes are on this right now, because if this succeeds, if this level of scaremongering, which I don't mean to downplay the roundups of Arab Americans and every other rights violation that's taken place on this war on terrorism, but this specific kind of blatant, coordinated, the ad campaigns, the legislation, the court cases, all of it gelling and working together to label nonviolent people as terrorists, if that works, it's going to be exploited and exported to other corporations and other organizations and industries that are combating other types of activists. So what that means is reaching out to mainstream Americans and telling them that labeling activists as terrorists wastes anti-terrorism resources. And to put in even more mainstream terms, I think it's an insult to everyone who died in the Twin Towers. This doesn't fit most mainstream interpretations of the word terrorism. That also means reaching out to coworkers, friends, and family and talking openly, honestly about the fear. And that's something I really missed on that afternoon talking with my coworker. I missed a really valuable opportunity to talk about the chilling effect of terrorism rhetoric, to talk about what the war on terrorism is doing internationally and domestically, and talking about what we could do about it. That was the window of opportunity then. Instead, I just completely passed it up because I was too focused on my task at hand and the things I wanted to do and getting ready for the testimony and all this kind of stuff, ignoring the real-life, concrete things that were right in front of me. It's important that we not let the scaremongering deter us from our work, whether it's writing letters to the editor or exposing factory farms, but it's equally important that we have supportive relationships ready to fight back when that war on terrorism comes home. So that is all I have right now. I'm going to be happy to open up to questions or comments and discussion. A few have made very wishy-washy statements. I think Conyers has as well, but which is interesting because he was actually involved in rushing it through. But they've been really wishy-washy. They're just saying, like, you know, we're committed to defending civil liberties and the First Amendment. We're also, and then they'll also say something like, we're also committed to combating extremism and you can't go outside the law, which totally sidesteps all the issues that I talked about today. So they're not coming out this strongly at all. McGovern was really an isolated instance.
Well, Dennis Kucinich has spoken out a couple times.
He has, but what was surprising about Kucinich was he was on the floor when, you know, he spoke out against the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act on the House floor. He was one of the six people in the room as part of the suspension of the rules, and he didn't call for a quorum. And if he would have done that, it would have blocked the vote and would have blocked the legislation. So that's, you know, something to keep in mind as well. He's by far done much more than any other member of Congress on this issue, but I think he still needs to be pushed.
Where are we?
It's over and done. Yeah, Bush signed it. It passed the Senate in September. They just took an identical bill. They dropped all their the other changes they were pushing for just to rush it through on that Monday, passed the House, and then it went to the President a couple weeks later, and he signed it,
so
of course. It's law.
I
think that's a discussion that needs to be had. I mean, from my standpoint, I don't see my role as talking about tactics or trying to shape. I'm just, you know, writing about this and trying to keep up to speed. But there are a lot of discussions going on about that right now, about, you know, should you push for repeal? Should you try to mobilize at the local level around the country to get a kind of a coalition? Should you start working with different organizations more? Which all sounds perfectly makes sense to me, but the only thing I've cautioned the activists about that I've talked to or that have called me about this is the idea of a test case, because I think we just need to constantly remember that the test case has already been fought and lost. I mean, the Shack 7 were convicted under the original legislation for running a website. I think the focus really needs to be on this was First Amendment activity. The original legislation, the scaled-down version, was used to go after First Amendment activity. Now it's, you know, pumped up on steroids with more penalties, more enhancements, broader, vaguer language, more vague language, and it just opens the floodgates. It was a pretty broad coalition that formed what was a front group called the Animal Enterprise Protection Coalition that was run by the National Association for Biomedical Research. And Pfizer and Wyeth and GlaxoSmithKline were some of the heavy hitters on it. And Glaxo was on the, before the House Judiciary Committee when I testified as well. He was one of the other witnesses, one of the four. But it's also had the University of California, which is a big heavy hitter and which got Feinstein on board as a Democratic co-sponsor. The University of California has come out because of some of their professors that do animal research have been targeted by animal rights activists. So you see California's University of California is on board. Then you have the usual suspects like the Fur Commission, all the meat industry groups, all the dairy industry groups, all the egg industry groups, a lot of the pharmaceutical coalitions. Anybody who has any association with animals was on board this legislation. I mean, we have like, what do you call them, dog and kennel clubs, like the breeding clubs. They were all on board this legislation. And these groups, you know, they're not always in the public spotlight and they always have the media attention, but they got a lot of money, especially pharmaceutical industry is, in New Jersey, where the Shack trial took place, is the pharmaceutical capital of the world. I mean, this is a multi-billion dollar industry. And so when all those heavy hitters are involved behind the scenes, I mean, that sends a very clear message to everyone else. Well, it's hard to talk in specifics about that because the government is not going to say anything like that, and I don't even think people even really know. But the two things I could say were that, you know, since September 11th, there's been this growth of joint terrorism task forces around the country. They're getting a lot of federal money, and they're supposed to be coordinating with local law enforcement, was the idea behind it. And once you start talking about federal legislation and start talking about terrorism, it brings in JTTF. So that they have a lot of money and resources, and a lot of the home raids and FBI visits activists have been experiencing have been through the Joint Terrorism Task Forces. So, I mean, the infrastructure is there to do a whole lot. I personally don't think there's going to be another huge case probably for a couple months or 6 months or a year, who knows, because at the end when the House finally passed this legislation, I think it said a lot to me that they rushed it through like that. They knew if they held out, even for a couple of days, it severely diminished their chances of getting the legislation through because activists had started finally getting their stuff together and organizing. And the public response was really bad. I mean, people were not in favor of this, and members of Congress heard that. So I think they kind of want to lay low a little bit. From a strategic standpoint, that's probably wise on their part. But who knows if it's going to be another roundup like Operation Backfire and charging people with property crimes from years and years ago, or if it's going to be another case like the Shack 7 where you're not charging them with any property crimes, you're charging them with First Amendment activity that incited illegal activity, or if you're just talking about a case like Adam Durand. Activists are doing kind of interstate coordination of undercover investigations of factory farms and egg producers and things like that. And they've really hit the industry hard. So who knows if that could come under fire from the terrorism legislation. Well, with the first part, I mean, I think it really was they saw their window of opportunity closing just a little bit. I mean, everything was kind of aligned in the best situation they've had in a long time to push this through. I mean, the war on terrorism rhetoric is still at a high. You have Republican-controlled House, Republican-controlled Senate, Republican in the White House, obviously. You know, you eliminate all that groundwork. Plus, you had the Operation Backfire cases recently, which elevated the eco-terrorism rhetoric to a national scale, I think more than a lot of things. You had the Shack 7 case, which bolstered them. Remember, this is the starting gun. It really got them revved up. And then you have all the other sustained kind of scaremongering campaigns. It all came together, and they saw that window closing, and they knew they had to just do a bum rush. But in terms of the second part, I think it's quite telling that only 6 members of Congress were on the House floor. And that it passed in the Senate, I didn't mention this before, by unanimous consent. So that means they didn't even take a roll call vote. A roll call vote is if a member or a senator says, we want a roll call, I'll go senator by senator, record everyone's vote. If something is so overwhelming, you can just do it by unanimous consent. That's how it passed the Senate, bipartisan. Passed the House, only 6 members of Congress were on the floor. I think it just says volumes about a couple of things. One, how isolated the animal rights and environmental movements are. Part of that is I think the animal rights and environmental movements have allowed themselves to be isolated through different tactical decisions. And part of that is corporations and politicians have done a really good job of separating them from everyone else. And it also reflects a lot about corporate influence of how drastic and how much money was funneled into this campaign and how much they didn't want to go against the corporate interests that were supporting it. And it also says a lot about how you can't divide things on party line. I mean, I think the animal rights and environmental movements especially have come to realize you just can't, go have a celebration party that the Democrats took control of the House and the Senate, which is good, and it marked an important change. But where were they on this legislation? Where were they on domestic spying? Where were they on... I would hesitate to use the word conspiracy because it's all out in the open. I mean, it's just all blatant. I mean, they're on...
The Democratic
Party was not there at all. Right. They weren't there at all. But, I mean, that being said, I don't think the message to take away from that is, screw the Dems. We're never going to be able to do anything with them. Obviously, you have to work with them. Obviously, you have to work with the Republicans because this is still, Congress. And whatever decisions are made there will impact people's lives. But to remember going into it that, don't put all your hopes in a party or a certain group of people because it's clear that when corporate interests and the war on terrorism rhetoric is at stake, people don't want to go against it. I think it's both, honestly. I mean, leading up to the Senate vote, there was no animal and environmental presence at all on Capitol Hill, at all. I mean, the Humane Society of the United States and the ACLU had both sent over letters when I testified, raising concerns, and then it dropped. I mean, there's no lobbying, there's no nothing. Feasibly, members of Congress, there are hundreds of bills that they have to consider on a regular basis. They have whole staffs working on different legislation. A lot of them may not have known about it. And like with the Patriot Act, I used to work at the American Civil Liberties Union when the Patriot Act was really in full swing. And one of the key things I learned there was how many members of Congress didn't read the whole bill. They didn't have a clue what was going on. And that was a 300 and some odd page piece of legislation. And this is, I'm going to pull it up, it's 3 pages. I mean, it's 3 pages. And in your first paragraph, I'm not a lawyer, I should have said that at the start, but being a lowly reporter who has covered Congress, that whole damaging or interfering with the operations of an animal enterprise just shoots up red flags with anybody paying attention. It's vague, it's overly broad, it's meaningless. It could be blatantly unconstitutional. But so to answer your question, it was both. There's no presence on Capitol Hill, and members of Congress just couldn't care less. And plus, you know, with when Feinstein came on board as a Democrat co-sponsoring this, it really silenced any opposition. Because not only did they not want to look soft on terror, which is how this was played, but they don't want to look like they're going to butt heads with Feinstein, who's a leader in the Democratic Party. And there's so many issues to butt heads about. Why care about, you know, those animal rights activists, those extremists? That's how it was pitched, and they did it well. You know, that's interesting with McGovern. I haven't looked at the Massachusetts clips to see how he was portrayed, but I know, well, I know, but I mean, just living and working in D.C. for a while now, both as a reporter covering Congress and doing, you know, stuff at the ACLU, it's obvious that's why they tried to push it before November campaign. For 2 reasons, for exactly that, to play up anybody who doesn't get on board as being soft on terrorism. And they would take it back to the local level and get corporations or whoever else involved in getting those people out of office. But also, I mean, the second part of that is if Republicans lost, if the Democrats took control, it would give them less of an advantage when they came back. So, I mean, it was clear they tried to rush it through. And on the Senate side, I should note, they passed it in the final hours. It was like the final 2 hours before November elections. It was part of an extended session. So if you go on Thomas and you look up when it was passed, it has some strange wording about how it was actually passed on the, what was it, the Sunday or the Saturday? But it was part of an extended session, so they give this little explanation, which in short means they're busting hump to try to get this done before everybody went to campaign. So the Republicans can say, we're tough on terror, and so they could turn to their opponents and say, you're soft on terror. It sounds silly, but that's how base all this is. Become. I think it's somewhere in between. I don't see how anyone on Capitol Hill could see all this going on and not be at least skeptical of it all. Even that's starting to come out a little bit within the GOP about, you know, domestic spying and habeas corpus and all this other stuff going on. So, I mean, if anyone tried to say these are just benign powers, I don't even think they would believe it themselves. But, I mean, that being said, you're right. I think this has to be put in a much broader context of everything else going on in the world. So when you put it in light of the Military Commissions Act, everything going on with habeas corpus, I mean, look at Lynn Stewart, the attorney who's jailed for material support. I mean, then you have all the Green Scare stuff, the broader domestic surveillance. You have DHS expanding all of their activities. You have things going on about extradition and sending people to, you know, third-party detention centers and, you know, torture and things going on at Gitmo. And this, you put everything in a much broader context, I think makes it even more damning. And a lot of the writing and speaking I've been doing, it's just been trying to, I think we all need to remember that, put this in a much broader context of what the broader direction everything is going, but at the same time remember, you know, chances are people aren't going to be hauled off to Guantanamo for attending a lecture or for protesting or whatever. But when you put things in a much broader context of all the powers that are there, if they want to use them now, that's when things really become dangerous, because it's just giving the government like a gesture of faith that we trust you're going to use these the right way. You know, you need these war on terrorism powers. Which, you know, a couple days after September 11th, 99% of the population probably said, sure, right? Everybody is scared. Everybody is worried about people flying planes into buildings. But when you lay that foundation and you give those powers away, then political opportunists like the NABR, Animal Enterprise Protection Coalition, National Rifle Association, anti-abortion groups, anyone you want to bring into the mix, Boeing going after anti-war protesters perhaps, all those powers are there on the table for them to put their hand out and take as well. Well, and on top of that, I mean, when I testified, the thing that truly blew me away after, you know, anyone who lives in D.C. for a while, you get pretty jaded, you get pretty cynical, especially writing about national security issues or whatever. But what truly blew me away was when the Department of Justice guy sat there and he said that the DOJ's hands are tied in going after animal rights extremists, that they don't have the powers they need to go after animal rights activists. Meanwhile, the Shack 7 had already been indicted. They hadn't been convicted yet. Operation Backfire, the roundups, had just taken place, and the announcement of the indictments were made just a few weeks ago. And he's acting, our hands are tied. And the doublespeak of it was just amazing to me. Nobody challenged him. No member of Congress challenged him at all about this. They all acted like this hasn't even happened. Operation Backfire, that, you know, we don't need to mention about that. We don't need to mention the Shack 7. We don't need to mention the grand jury as the no-fly list, the congressional witch hunts. We don't need to mention anything. As long as you can keep that element of fear going. And that's what, I mean, what was key with the Shack 7 case as well, when all these members of Congress say it's not going to be used to go after First Amendment activity, that's bunk because it already has been used. But they don't even want to touch it. The ACLU, I mean, at that House Judiciary Committee hearing, they sent a letter that was nearly identical to the Humane Society letter, raising a bunch of concerns. The bill that was considered in the Senate was just a little bit better. I mean, it sounded like a hillbilly, but what I posted on my website was it was perfuming a pig, is what we call it back home. It's just the stench just was a little bit more sweet, you know? It's so a horrible bill, and it was overly broad and vague. But then the ACLU was silent. And actually when, you know, James Sensenbrenner was on the House floor for the suspension of the rules trying to rush this through, he held up the ACLU letter to him from a few days earlier saying, we will not oppose this legislation. And as someone who's worked at the ACLU and has been involved in all the legislative issues, also someone who's covered it, that gave the green scare a green light. It was just no holds barred. Because when you have the ACLU, which is seen as the civil liberties powerhouse in the country, especially on Capitol Hill, they really do have clout, serious clout on Capitol Hill. When you say we do not oppose, go for it.
Didn't they say something?
I really don't. I mean, and it's led to a little awkwardness with some folks over there, but some people over there aren't happy as well. The state affiliates are pissed because, you know, the ACLU operates with the two national offices and then all the state affiliates around the country, and the state affiliates are not happy about this. A lot of people have been calling their offices, and so it's definitely on their issue, and I think they're much more aware of things going on now. And I think there's a feeling among a lot of people that the ball was dropped. But it's, again, I mean, what do you even say to that? It's just too little, too late. I mean, people have a responsibility to be on board on issues like this, just like the Democrats had the responsibility to at least be in the room when a piece of terrorism legislation was passed. I mean, that's the bare minimum we can ask of anybody.
I just wanted to point out that the less well-funded but more stalwart National Lawyers Guild has been a staunch opponent of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act.
And I think that's key to note, too, because also pulling out another Red Scare analogy, during the Red Scare, the ACLU came under a lot of fire for getting alleged communists off of their board. The NLG is who stepped up, kind of got their teeth kicked in a little bit over it, but they stepped up and they did not back down on fighting the Red Scare. And now it's the exact same thing again. The ACLU backed out, the NLG is stepping up. And it's unfortunate that we have to go through all this all over again. Because working at the ACLU, I mean, that was, it's still a red mark on their history. It's something that sometimes people try to defend and this and that, but it's seen as, in a lot of ways, a huge mistake. A good news website that just strictly usually posts news articles and updates is FBI Witch Hunt, and it's all focused on this stuff. And they really just post a link to the news article. And they'll post news about a grand jury or what you can do and things like that. But it's pretty cut and dry. Another website is greenscare.org, which I think was in one of these slides. It's not updated very often from what I can tell, but it's also kind of a portal thing. They have a bunch of links to different prisoners and different websites and kind of little bits and pieces of background. There's NOADA, which is the Equal Justice Alliance, which is animal groups that are reaching out to civil liberties groups and others to start moving forward on this. And then, of course, you can check out Green is the New Red, and that's my website with articles, and also have links to all the things I mentioned, all the organizations I mentioned. It's also a blog, so I try to post about 3 times a week. Well, for the latter part, I think a lot of national groups have bought into the rhetoric and tried to distance themselves from the terrorists, so-called terrorists. Humane Society has done that, and a bunch of other organizations. I mean, I think there is, it's obviously really tricky for activists because, I mean, take the Operation Backfire cases. One, I mean, do you really want to go all out opposing their arrest and saying they're innocent? Well, you don't know if they're innocent. You know, who knows? Maybe they actually did all those crimes. I mean, do you really want to go out on a limb saying a statement like that when you don't know? And I would encourage people to not jump on a bandwagon like that and just have a visceral reaction and be careful about what you say. But at the same token, you know, you have to be careful what you say because obviously, you know, most people do not support the tactics or the crimes that were committed in the name of the environment, whether those people are did them or not. So you have to be careful about how you talk about that within your movement. And you have to be careful about how you relay all that, all those complicated issues to the public. And so what I've been trying to do just on the website is talk about it in terms of, all right, I don't know these people. I know them now, or some of them now. But I didn't know them then. But I do know that look at things in the broader context of the war on terrorism. Look at the domestic spying, the detainee situation, Guantanamo, with the no-fly list. Look at everything else going on, and then tell me I should not give these defendants at least the benefit of the doubt, to not at least be extremely critical of any government action in this war on terrorism. I mean, I think to just lay that foundation, that's the bare minimum we can ask of anyone, is you have to be critical of all this going on. It doesn't matter if you oppose or support, you know, radical tactics or whatever. It doesn't matter if you're an environmentalist or animal rights activist. You have a bare minimum responsibility to be extremely critical of sweeping government powers and to be extremely critical of the government saying, we caught the terrorists, and then patting themselves on the back, sending out press releases, holding press conferences just a little bit before the statute of limitations expired and as they're getting pressured by corporations to deliver results and to catch the people that did these crimes. That's what I would say is just the bare minimum. And anything beyond that is, you know, people have to decide on their own what they're comfortable talking about. Thanks, everybody, for coming, and thanks to the groups here at NLG and the Animal Group for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was journalist Will Potter speaking last February before the University of Washington Student Legal Animal Defense Fund. Will Potter has a very interesting website, www.greenisthenewred.com. Greenisthenewred.com. Thanks to Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters for that recording. And you can download an MP3 of this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.